Accession number 19665, Reel 3.
Jim Dunning, Reel 3.
Yes, well, when we were doing this amphibious training, we were just more or less just off the beach, actually, among some trees, and we just slept out in the open. It was a marvellous, as I said, just at that time of the year, it was a lovely climate. And we stayed, must have been training for about a month, and mid-January, we moved off to Chittagong, back to Chittagong, and we embarked on a troop ship in Chittagong. I think it was the SS Nevada. And off we sailed from Chittagong. It wasn't very far because we sailed during the night. And in the morning we arrived off Ramry Island. We weren't the first wave. We were the second wave ashore, so we had to wait a bit until the first wave went in. I can remember there was a big boat. It was HMS Queen Elizabeth, I think, one of these big battleships, and she was laid right on the horizon because there were quite a few warships shelling, and the troops went in. Then we followed them. We were in the second wave, and we had to get down off the troop ship into these small landing craft down these scrambling nets with our kit on, which was quite a feat really. But it was calm. It was very calm. It didn't have any bother at all. And we landed on Ramry Island, and we sort of went so far into the interior. And then we were on operations on Ramry Island.
So the landing was unopposed?
Very lightly opposed, yes. So we were the second wave in, and we had no opposition. We got off the beach and inland and dug ourselves in. There was a little bit of opposition, but not a lot, really. I think they sort of melted away and got off the island, the other side of the island, I understand, the Japanese. But there was at the onset, there was quite a bit of opposition. And we stayed on Ramry Island three weeks to a month. And then we were back onto the landing craft, and off we went. And we went and we landed on them. We were the first wave ashore onto the mainland at a place called Letpan, I think it was. I'm sure it was Letpan. And our company was the first wave ashore. We had to wear these. We had some air support. And we had to wear these red pieces of cloth on our shoulders so the aeroplanes could see where we were, because it was such funny country. And the Americans were supporting us on this landing, and the Americans came in and they could easily have shot us up, really, but just missed us. They came in too soon, really. I always remember this. But anyway, we were the first wave ashore. We got ashore, and there was very little opposition there, very little. This was a place called Letpan. I also remember going up what they called Shongs. They were called Shongs. It was a tidal sort of inlets, only narrow, with these little narrow landing boats. I remember thinking at the time, if anybody had opened fire on us going up this shore from the shore, we wouldn't have had a chance, really. And another thing, that you always think little things come back to you, don't you? I always remember when you were sort of assembling to go out to sail on these little landing craft, there was a hospital ship in, and we passed this hospital ship, and all the nurses came on deck and waved to us, and I always remember that, all into the uniforms, as we passed this hospital ship, these nurses waving to us. And I remember thinking at the time, we're nice to be on there with all those nurses looking after us. We got off onto the mainland, but again, with very little opposition. We were the first company ashore, which is quite a frightening thing, really. You can never know what's going to happen. Then off we went. The idea was we were supposed to be going down the coast, well, it wasn't a road, down the coast to a place called Tangup, which was a depot for the Japanese, I think. It was a road head to a place called Prome, more in central Burma, and it was important, quite a strategic place was Tonop. The idea was to go down there and take it, and it took us quite some time to get down there. And this was a quite horrific experience going down there, because it was a track on the road, a rough track on the road. I mean, it must have been a couple hundred miles away, it was Tonop, I would have thought, to get there. And all on the side of the road was these little hills, and it was very dense jungle, I think they call it secondary jungle. It was very thick, not big trees, not real tall trees, but sort of very sort of short, scrubby sort of land, and bushy, and it was in places impenetrable in places when you got off the road. And there was these hills on the small hills. They would only reach about 500 feet, not much more than 500 foot, these hills on the side of the road. And these were potential places where the Japs would, this marvellous place from a defensive point of view for the Japs. And all the way down, we seemed to be leapfrogging through one company to another, going down towards Tonop, and having to take these hills where the Japs were. The bodies going up these hills, it was just ridiculous, really, because I mean, it was almost impossible to get up them. You had to find a special way up, and you're advancing on very narrow tracks. We had quite a lot of casualties, actually. Well, quite a few casualties taking these hills, and it was quite a horrific experience. It wasn't like a normal warfare where you're broad, expanded like a desert or France. I mean, it was just sort of so enclosed was the space, really. You couldn't see from here to that, you know, about 50 yards or so in places.
How much opposition were the enemy putting up?
Oh, there were quite a lot at times, yes. Yeah, there weren't a lot about them, but I mean, 15 or 20 people could sit on top of hill, and it would take some shifting. I mean, they were fanatics, really, to being sort of ridiculous. I mean, they didn't believe in being taken prisoner. But our battalion never took a prisoner. All the time we were there, we never took a prisoner. All the time with that. I think a lot of that happened out in out there, and people kept quiet about it.
Would you have taken a prisoner if you had been able to?
I think it would depend on the circumstances, really. But I mean, these little engagements that sort of happened so quickly, and it seemed to be over so quickly, and there was only sort of done as a platoon strength, about 30 people in a platoon. And you'd bump into these Japanese on these hills, and there'd be a firefight, and they would melt away in the distance, and that would be it. And they'd take the wounded with them. So, I mean, there weren't any prisoners. We never took any. I think this was general, really, I think.
Did you lose any prisoners? Any of your men prisoners?
Yeah, we lost. I can remember losing one as a prisoner. Yes, one was captured in our platoon. It was down at, you know, it was a sort of short, very narrow topped hills, and not much on the top of them. And when you're advancing, you'd have so many down one side of the hill, and so many on the other, and so many on the top advancing down this down the hill, and I know this chap was right at the bottom, on the left-hand side of the bottom, and I don't know how it happened, but he just disappeared. And we never heard of him again, so I presumed he'd been taken prisoner. Never heard of him. But I mean, there wasn't any sort of what we said. We weren't involved in any what you sort of call large-scale fighting. It was all this nerve-wracking, sort of small sort of close sort of fighting, sort of on. In sort of, you know, very constricted spaces.
What was your job with the platoon at that time?
I was a section commander, and then we had to take a hill, and our platoon sergeant was ill, and I was promoted platoon sergeant, and I was with the officer, we had to sort of take a another hill, and we just got started, and he was shot. So I was left in charge of the platoon. So, no, it was a very, I mean, I know people say, I mean, it was rough anywhere, but it was quite hair-raising, really. And the worst part of it could be the nights out there, because the Japs had an awful way of coming and getting as close to you as they could do and shouting at you. You can see these chaps shouting, Johnny this and Johnny that, and the war's over and we'll come and get you. And one thing that we could hear these people shouting, it was very, very hair-raising. And then they'd start laughing. You could hear this ridiculous laugh in the distance.
What kind of a laugh?
Well, sort of a cackly, sort of a shrieky, sort of a laugh. Yes, it was most sort of inhuman, really. So, no, it was. As I say, you couldn't see sort of apart from your own little platoon. I mean, you weren't, so you couldn't see anybody. It wasn't like being in the middle of a desert where you could see all sorts of people about, but you couldn't see. It was most restricted. It could be quite unpleasant. And then water was a problem as well. It was a tribal problem with water, because you used to go onto these hills and stop up there and take so much water with you. But I mean, it didn't last very long, and you had to send somebody down back to the bottom to the headquarters to get some more water, and then that was an awful job, and coming back again. And of course, we were only on these dry sort of army rations, compo rations, biscuits and little bits, tins of meat and things like that. We could brew up some in the daylight. We could brew up and have enough cups of tea. So then it was a peculiarity of the district. They sort of all, I mean, you had the sea at one side of you, and then you had these hills at the other. And that every hill had to be taken, but I mean, it was a potential danger spot for Japanese. It was ideal defensive situation, really. I can also remember that time when my officer was killed, that we were waiting to put this attack in, and we're looking across through the tree, and we could see that warship, the Queen Elizabeth, anchored not so far away. And through our glasses, we could see all these sailors laid out with on the deck, sunbathing. I thought, crikey, I'd swap places with you any day. And a few minutes after that, we had to put this attack in, and the platoon commander was killed.
How did it happen?
This shot was, we got up to put this attack in, and he was just shot soon after we got started. And then we got so far and then I can remember being relieved by this Sikh battalion. They came up afterwards and relieved us.
What was he like as a platoon commander?
He was a marvellous, lovely chap, yes. And chap, I think it was called Parrot, I think. Yeah, nice chap. He came from round here somewhere, but he'd been in New Guinea, actually. When we did this jungle training, so many of the officers were sent out to New Guinea to do jungle training out there and get sort of, I don't know why they went out there, to get first-hand information of what it was like in jungle conditions. I don't know why they couldn't go in other parts of Burma, but I don't remember going out to New Guinea and being seconded to the Australian Army out there. But that must have been a usual practice. He was a lovely chap. Mm. Which not very nice. I know I started off in the morning as a section commander and ended up in charge of the platoon in the end. So that was it, really. And we kept going down. This was in March, April, wasn't it? We kept going down this coast road, as I say, sort of leapfrogging on. And we got so far down, and then the two battalions that we were with in our brigade, they were Indian battalions, and they were pulled off out of the brigade, because they were just building up to invade, capture Rangoon, and they were pulled off and sent back to go with the division to capture Rangoon. And we were left because the reason why we were left was because there was a West African division working with us, and there was a bit of I didn't realise until afterwards, there was quite a bit of unrest because the West Africans saw that the English were, you know, there weren't many English about and they were having the best part of it. So they kept the English battalion, we were attached to the West African division, and they kept, you know, and the Indian regiments, they went off with the rest of the division. But I could never understand why we didn't go, but that's the reason why we were seconded to this West African division to more or less sort of not keep the peace, but just to show them that there were white people there as well. But the West African division, I thought, were lovely, really. Great big chaps. They had these enormous boats, size 10 or 12 boats. Always chafing, always laughing. I thought they were out. We thought that we got on very well with them. I mean, the white officers and white NCOs, but the rest of them were just absolutely West Africans. They must have been like us. I mean, they must have come from West Africa as green as we were when we left England. But we got on with them very well. Anyway, we kept going down this road, and we'd had some time, it was tight tiring, and after we got to the outskirts of Tongup, which was the idea, that's what was our objective, really. And there was quite a bit of resistance, but not a lot, and we got round the back of Tongup, and the Japs just melted away. They went down the road to Prome, I think. There was a main road from Tongup to Prome. And they melted away to Prome. That would be May. It must have been May 1945, May to June 1945. And we went through. We took Tongup and went past Tongup and went so far down until we got to a place called Sanway or something. And we stopped there, and that's really where the hostility part of my sort of experience sort of fizzled out. Because shortly after that, Rangoon was taken, and as far as we could, it's finished. But first, I mean, there was such a lot of fuss about Rangoon, but when they got there was nobody there. There was an unopposed landing at Rangoon, so we sort of. So we didn't miss much, we were lucky in a way. And we stayed in Sandaway for about a month, I think, if I remember rightly. The monsoon was just starting, it was getting awful, really, and then we came back to England. It's funny, I remember it used to take ages and ages to do any travelling in Vietnam. I remember getting on these coastal steamers. Somewhere near, must have been near Sandaway, and having to go up to Chittagong on this coastal steam, and we get off this coastal steam and ship all our baggage onto this troop ship in Chittagong, and we went off across from Chittagong to Madras. And in Madras I was put in charge of the advance party, and we went up to a barracks in Meerut, just outside Delhi. And we sort of went complete circles. We were back to sort of, well, I won't say peacetime soldiering, but to the old sort of style of Indian soldiering, really.
Yeah. Were you still in India when partition occurred?
No, I left. I left a battalion in October 1945. Went by train to Bank. There was 60 of us left the battalion to come home, and 30 of us were allowed to come by plane, and 30 of us were allowed to go by boat, and we tossed up for it. I drew the car to come by plane. I think that was another fantastic experience. I'd never seen an aeroplane in my life before. Well, not been on an aeroplane. And we boarded this aeroplane at Barrack Park. I mean, it was a journey of a lifetime, really. It was an old converted Liberator, a bomber, bringing them back with troops. And I remember flying to Delhi, then to Karachi, then to Basra, I think it was on the Persian Gulf, and then to somewhere in Palestine, then to Morocco and all over. And back to England, we arrived in England on November the 11th, 1945. We got back to Beverley. We came back to Beverley Station because there was a depot of the greenhouse at Beverley, in the barracks at Beverley. We got back to Beverley Station, and when we got to Beverley Station, we met the contingent in Beverley Station who'd come by boat, and they'd got to England before we had, the day before us.
How do you feel now about having served in the Green, Howards and Burma in the Second World War?
I'm very proud, really. It's one of these experiences. I mean, I wouldn't like to repeat it, I'll admit. And I was exceptionally lucky, really. I mean, it's like a lottery, isn't it, going into the services? You just go where you're sent and that's it. I mean, it was a lottery that I went out to the Far East and went to join the Green Hours and up on the frontier in Burma, really. I mean, we had no control over it at all. Looking back, I mean, I think I was proud and pleased to have done it. And it's, I think a lot of service people say the same thing, but it isn't often a day goes past without something cropping up that reminds you of something. I don't know what it is, why it is what it is. I mean, I can't remember things that happened in my business 20 years ago, but time and time again, something just sort of flits back in your memory and you think about these things. I don't know why.
Could I ask you about farming in the East Riding? Because you were telling me some interesting things about land ownership and social relations for farmers in Bishop Burton area.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I always think that some of these estates were, I won't say by dubious means, but if you just happened to be on the right place at the right time in the olden days, you were handed an estate for something that you'd done. I remember the first landlord of Bishop Burton was a chap called G, and he was the secretary to King James the First, and that's how we got Bishop Burton estate. And then he went bankrupt, and a family called the Hallwatt family bought the estate. And there again, they were heavily involved in sugar, and they came from Liverpool, and we always said that they made their fortune out of slaves, really. But anyhow, they bought the Bishop Burton estate. But when I was young, it was looking back on it now, I mean, how feudal the system was in those days. It was just like a little kingdom, really. The landlord and his wife there were absolutely big boss. I mean, they sort of, I won't say they ruled the village with an iron fist, but they were in complete charge and they made all the decisions. And it was always a joke that all the village business was done after an evensong at church over a glass of sherry with the vicar, and they made all the decisions and nobody else had a look in. If you didn't go to church, it was frowned on. They wanted to know why you weren't at church. And if any young girl got into trouble in the village, I mean, she had to be off straight away. I mean, she was, I won't say handed out of the village, but she wasn't allowed to live in the village. And other things, I mean, they were quite good. I mean, any ill person in the village, they all used to send food down and come down and see them. And they looked after you in those days. We always had to tip your cap whenever you saw them. And we had a big Christmas party when we were young as well. We went in the school, and they used to give all the children presents, and they used to come to this Christmas party, and we used to have to make a fuss of them and sing songs. Looking back, it was a very feudal system. But I think that's passed now. Death duties helped to break up a lot of these estates, and fortunately we were, as a farmer, we are fortunate enough to be able to buy our farms when the estate was sold for death duties.
Who was the big landowner in the 30s?
That with the Hallwatt family, they were the big landowners. Yes, they owned all the estate. But there was a depression in the there was a depression all over the world in the 1930s, and the landowners had a job letting farms because the agriculture was such in a poor position they couldn't find people to take them on, and they more or less let people take the farms for nothing for a few years. And if it hadn't been for the war, it would have been in a parlous state, really, with agriculture, but things changed dramatically when the war started. I mean, such a shortage of food, and prices went rocketing up, and I think the farmers did very well, really.
Did you ever get into trouble your family through not attending church yourself?
No. Yes, we're lucky. Well, my uncle was a church warden. We were quite heavily involved with the church, really. No, yes. But they did look. I mean, they weren't very pleased if anybody missed. You know, there were people missing. They wanted to know why they weren't there. It was a very looking back. It was a very feudal system. It wouldn't work today. I mean, nobody would stand it. Because all the people in the village in those days, they all worked either in agriculture, or else they worked up at the hall where the landlord lived. I mean, some were butlers and maids and what have you, working in the hall or working on the farm outside the hall. I mean, they was very heavily involved in hunting. Was the landlord, and he rode to hounds, and he was a magistrate. And we wondered what he. I mean, that's how they spent their lives, really, in entertaining.
But weren't there any independent people in the village, like cobblers or?
Yes, they were. They were independent as much as they were worked for themselves. But they were sort of tenants of the landlord because they were occupying their landlord's premises. I mean, all the little shops belonged to the landlord, and he let them to these various people.
But say you were a Catholic or a non-conformist.
There was a non-conformist chapel and a Baptist chapel. But, I mean, they were allowed to go. I mean, there were people who attended those chapels as well. Yes, in those days. No, they weren't anti sort of non-conformists, but they were Church of England. And given the Judas did an awful lot of restoration in the church, they must have spent thousands of pounds restoring the church. They did a lot of good, really. But there was just that other side of it, whereas they were the kings, really.
Did they come around in cars or on horses?
Well, he was a keen rider, was the landlord. Mostly cars used to come around. We didn't see much of them, really. And they had an agent who lived in the village. So they kept to themselves apart from important occasions.
How did the agent behave?
Well, he was a chap, you had to keep the right side of the agent, because he was a chap who liaised between you and the landlord, so you had to keep on the right side of the agent if he wanted anything doing. Yes, he was a Scotsman. The sad part about it was in the village was that when the late landlord bought the estate, there were some lovely cottages in the village, and there were such low rents, I think they were only paying 5 shillings a week for these rents, and if they wanted a new boiler, a new fireplace, and that was a year's rent. So this chap was a trawler owner, and he was a real businessman, and he wouldn't have it at all. So to cut his losses, he gave all the small country little cottages away to the council. When they'd have been worth a small fortune today with these little cottages, but the council took them over and knocked them all down and built sort of council houses. Which is a shame, really, because it spoilt the character of the village to a certain extent.
What was the name of the trawler owner?
Hellier Brothers. He was a big trawler owner in Hull.
And he took over from Hull Watts?
Yes, he took over from Hull Watts. But unfortunately, he had to sell the estate when he died. Through death duties, he had to sell the estate. But his granddaughter lives next door to us, and we're quite friendly with him, so it's amazing how... Oh, it's all turned full circle now because we're very friendly. We live next door to each other.
And that's when you bought the farm?
That's right, when we bought the farm, when the estate was sold. And yes, which was the best thing we ever did, really. It was very good.